This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
I'm Stephen Mitchell. I'm the co-author of A Thousand Names for Joy by Byron Katie and of many other books. And I would like to express my appreciation to Duncan Campbell for his program, Living Dialogues. He's a wonderful interviewer. Every time I'm on, I have great fun, and he draws out fascinating things that I didn't even know I had in me to say. I appreciate him, and I appreciate what he makes available to a wide audience.
So this is Byron Katie, the author of A Thousand Names for Joy, and I Need Your Love Is That True, and Loving What Is. I appreciate Duncan Campbell and Living Dialogues as it reaches so many people and is so consistent, helping people reach an understanding that they already have. He's the one that connects people to that, and I'm so grateful.
From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a Daya flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues. Welcome once again to Living Dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell. And again, I'm delighted to have as my guests Byron Katie and Stephen Mitchell to continue our conversation about their co-authored book, A Thousand Names for Joy, which consists of Byron Katie's commentaries on various passages of the Tao Te Ching, translated by her husband, Stephen Mitchell, and published more than a quarter of a century ago. Byron Katie is known to literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people all over the world for what she calls the work, a method of self-realization and self-awareness that she developed based on her own experience of awakening over 20 years ago. Stephen Mitchell is also known worldwide for his translations of many of the great spiritual texts of the world, including the Bhagavad Gita, the Tao Te Ching, the Book of Genesis, the Book of Job, Gilgamesh, and numerous others. More about Byron Katie and Stephen Mitchell can be found on thework.com and also Stephen Mitchell's website, stephenmitchellbooks.com. So in this particular part two of our ongoing conversation with Byron Katie and Stephen Mitchell, we're going to begin by recapping a bit of what we said in the last dialogue concerning the nature of love, and we'll continue from there. Katie begins by recapitulating why it only makes sense to really love everyone. In the most profound way, this is not simply wishful thinking or being a good person. It is actually being who we really are.
I invite everyone to love because, to love everyone. Because until we do, we're just not comfortable. And the opposite of, love is what we're opposing in that person, we could say. And it's only something in ourselves. So when we wake up to that, it doesn't leave anyone to not like. And especially when it's a strong dislike.
And the title of your first book together, Loving What Is. And often we hear the mystical so-called statement, love is, the nature of consciousness is love. And when one experiences that and has that unity consciousness, people often describe it as love, but not in the sense of effortine or territoriality or need or any of the things that we might conventionally put the label on.
One of the things that I personally love so much about A Thousand Names for Joy is that it unpacks the phrase loving what is and gives specific stories in Katie's life that might seem impossible for a human being to be experiencing, like hearing that you have cancer and loving that, or having your house emptied out by burglars, or standing in front of a man who has a revolver pushed into your belly. And the stories give readers, I've heard many early readers with this impression, a vivid portrait of what it is to actually love what is, whatever it is, whether it's what people might normally experience as disaster, something like watching the attack on the World Trade Center, or being with your mother who's dying of pancreatic cancer, or hearing that you yourself have cancer, any of these experiences. And there, this book is full of the vivid stories like that about how it feels to go through any experience with lightheartedness and open-heartedness and a mind that doesn't dwell anywhere, as the Diamond Sutra says, is the essence of Dharma. So it fleshes out, it unpacks that phrase, loving what is, in a most wonderful and helpful way, in my experience.
And that's the part I like, mm-hmm. When I hear Stephen say helpful, in a most helpful way. That's my interest.
Mm-hmm. And it arises naturally because, mm-hmm. you know, like in all the great texts, we go back to the Bhagavad Gita, one of the great texts that Stevens has also translated and brought through in, I think, a very essential core essence way. It is seva. It is the karma yoga. It is being of service to others that eventually is the only action that makes sense to the non-existent self, to the self that is simply there. And it's what you do.
Yes, it's only adding to yourself. Every time you give or contribute, it's adding to yourself. And you know, there's an questioned mind. You know, it's like it's not possible to live out of a motive, not mm-hmm. even the motive of peace or love or any of it. It is just awake to its own nature, mm-hmm. and one term for that is love. But you know, the mind, the love affair, mind to itself, you know, mind ending the war with itself, the mind that loves everything it thinks, the mind that has ceased to not understand itself. You know, projection still happens. It's just that when you love everything you think, you love everything you see. It's not a choice. It ceases to be a choice. Mm-hmm. It's you know, it's over. Mm-hmm. And then the mind, because it's no longer stuck in what it believes, is free to be the power that it is, you know, creation, just infinite, total power.
Yeah, another one of the great paradoxes that oftentimes strikes people as a real conundrum, which is, not my will, but thine be done.
Mm.
And people think of that, well, does that mean I have to surrender to some institutional church or to a priest or to the Pope or to somebody else's idea of reality? But from the perspective of experience that you're describing, the freedom, paradoxically, is in the choicelessness that
yes.
you just simply manifest what needs to be manifested.
Yes.
And you don't have to choose anymore, because if you're open-hearted, the answer, as you say, when you're doing the work and your interaction in the dialogue, just comes to you by being open to the person. And to the person, it may strike them as really a huge insight that maybe resided in you and that you gave to them.
Yes.
But then they gradually understand that their participation in being open and vulnerable and expressing their confusion and their desires is actually what's being mirrored back to them, and it becomes self-clarifying.
Mm-hmm.
And you, of course, call that to their attention,
mm-hmm.
and say, it's not me, honey, it's you yeah. that's having this clarity.
Yeah, it's like, where did that answer come from?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was yours. You know, what you've just experienced came out of you. And thank you for my part And, you know, we're partners in this, and in fact, even closer than that. Mm-hmm. One mind.
Having a dialogue with itself.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's so heart-opening. I know from doing the work myself, I described it to you earlier, the experience I had out there in Barstow with you and those other people that were with us, maybe 15 or 20 in those days when I came for that 3 or 4 day visit, and how powerful it was for that setting and your work and the people there who co-created it with me and with you.
Yes.
It was so transformative for me, and I had that experience in that moment, and it's never left me. I mean,
yes.
it's like an awakened imprint that then opens so many other channels in your life.
And yes.
I go back to Stephen's comment that it was interesting that before he would commit himself, having trained for many years in meditation and immersed himself in these great spiritual texts so profoundly that he could bring forth the pure stream of the meaning without sullying it with his own personalistic interpretation. That was the last thing he wanted to make sure, was that were you one of the people of whom we've seen, sadly, a number, who when they bring forth their gift and then are projected upon by the people hungry for nurturing, get overwhelmed and fall prey to either a money problem or a sex problem or a power problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extraordinarily difficult to hold that space if there is any spot on the mirror, because the projections of the people will go right to that spot, and it'll either be cleansed or it will become very problematic. And so when Stephen said, you know, for someone to work with you in the way he does, they have to be themselves without jealousy, because there's so many people that are giving you their attention, their support, their
lives,
their love,
their lives. You know,
yeah.
when a person gives me their deepest, darkest belief, or they tell me what they believe, mm-hmm. they're giving me themselves, their mm-hmm. identity, their whole lives. And mm-hmm. we begin to disassemble that as I ask the questions and they answer them. And mm-hmm. there's nothing more intimate than that.
And so one of the things I'd like to ask is, in the relationship as you began working on the translation and the putting together of the book, the translation of the work, we might say, into the engaging narrative of loving what is, when did it occur that the two of you decided to get married?
Well, you know, Stephen is very clear, and I don't see how something like that could ever occur to me. I'm already married. You know, I'm married. My mind, you know, again, this is complete. You know, nothing can add or subtract from this. But Stephen he's a remarkable man, and he said, you know, will you marry me? And I just became very still, and for weeks, maybe a year, I don't know. I think Stephen could probably tell you, or longer.
Some people might have a problem with that, but
I was waiting to see why not,
mm-hmm.
and my mind couldn't give me a reason why not, mm-hmm. and I'm probably. It's like I love that it was Stephen, because I'm living with Stephen is it's an amazing experience, and he was just very clear, you know, let's get married, and then.
And Stephen, what prompted that on your own part?
It felt like we were married already, mm-hmm. so I wanted the outside to match the inside,
mm-hmm. and that
and
was
then,
correct.
And Katie was looking for a reason why not, and she called her children, and she mm-hmm. called her mother.
I called mm-hmm. Paul.
Mm-hmm. Paul, and, your ex-husband.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And nobody could find a reason. And then one day we were in New York, and I said, let's go over to Tiffany's, and we found a very simple ring, and it just unfolded like that. There's a very funny passage in the book about Katie not knowing even the moment before that there was a wedding going to happen, and mm-hmm. and And it did. And I was amazed that she still has her wedding ring after 6 years, because she tends to give away even very expensive presents when somebody likes it. So, and she actually tried to give away the wedding ring to a mutual friend of hers, mm-hmm. and he gave it right back. But
yes. I remember that story. Yes,
it just,
he gave it back the next day, I think.
It just happened with its own intelligence. And
well, it seems, it's very interesting to me. I'm intrigued because, you know, we have the convention in society, which I think is true across many cultures, not all, but many that we're aware of, where it's the man who does the proposing and the woman who does the accepting and may withhold her judgment. She may wait until the time is right or whatnot. And what do you think, one of you, that may have to do with the nature of masculine and feminine in that wonderful interaction?
Well, you know, we did wait until the time was right. Mm-hmm. And it was very surprising. Mm-hmm. And I knew Stephen would know. Mm-hmm. And that's how it worked out.
Mm-hmm. I think of a poem of Rumi's at one point. He was talking about the masculine. I think he was putting the Shiva Shakti thing in its traditional way on its head, manifesting, and the feminine says yes to the manifestation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's one way of thinking about it. You know, so I went to propose to my own wife, and I had the thought, and I put my arms around her, and she was at the kitchen sink, and she turned around before I could even open my mouth, and she said, yes.
Yeah.
And it was remarkable.
Beautiful.
Yeah, very beautiful.
You know, it's something that I've never even told you, honey, and it just came to me, is Stephen has such discernment, mm-hmm. and he's amazing that way. And people put terms on me like enlightened, and on terms that I've never understood and don't have an interest in. It's like, if I am, how would I know? It's not possible. And living with Stephen, if there is something that would surface, he would feel it, smell it, taste it, be on top of it, mm-hmm. and give it to me. It's like living with the clearest, most wonderful awareness. As a husband.
I have a pretty well-developed bullshit detector.
Mm-hmm.
And
And I can laugh, I can joke, I can say anything, and there's it doesn't matter what I say. There's it's a wonderful thing to be married to such a mirror, and I think we all are.
And I think that's the nature of our relationship. I recall a spiritual teacher I had who said, if you want to accelerate your own awakeness, get married.
Yeah, get married.
Eddie always talked about marriage as a meeting of these two spiritual friends, and we're witnessing and supporting this saying yes to each other, this spiritual friendship where each will support each other. Is it Rilke, Stephen, I think it is, who talked about the nature of the depth of the sacred marriage is supporting each other's sacred solitude.
Oh, in Letters to Young Poet, yeah. He has a wonderful passage about that.
Yeah. And so the solitude of the itness rather than the me-ness, and respecting mm-hmm. that and mm-hmm. supporting that rather than trying to, as we see in so many of your dialogues with couples that, or one member of the couple who's agonized because, I recall one young man named Bruce in your book, mm-hmm. who's agonizing because his woman has left him.
Oh, and yeah. I Need Your Love?
Yes.
No, it's in this book.
Oh, in the new book. Bruce mm-hmm. and Sheila, is it? I forget.
But anyway, he has the very firm conviction that she abandoned him.
Exactly. He knows that that happened as a fact. And then you start over the questions. Can you absolutely know this is true? And it's absolutely, it happened. And then you embark on this long, wonderful dialogue with him. And in the end, he begins to have that wonderful sense of humor about himself. And the audience is laughing. And he's laughing. And he's reading what he wrote. And he said, it seems so absurd now that I would say this. You know.
Yeah, so he was awake.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
To that.
I love the dialogues in the book, too, because you can see the moment when somebody mm-hmm. is going through that internal process and saying, oh, my God, could this not be true? This thing that is my religion, is, you know, I would have died for, uh-huh. the belief that she abandoned me. Uh-huh. could it possibly not be true? And then Katie guides him into the cause and effect of believing that. And it's just wonderful having a front row seat in somebody's inner life.
Mm-hmm. And beautifully done, because it's so vulnerable with the sangha, we might say. The audience is there. And instead of feeling shamed or exposed, the person held in that space feels liberated. And he laughs right along with the audience. And there's this sense of great community. That's what happened to me, actually. What happened to me when I was doing the work out there with you in Barstow was the sense of tremendous vulnerability, but it was so powerful, there was no embarrassment to it.
Yes.
And it flowed right into the liberation. That's the remarkable thing about the work. People may hold back thinking, gee, do I want to get up there in front of all these people? But actually, when one does it,
it's quite different.
It's quite different.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, so one of the things I think that we might talk about here, Stephen, is in going back and forth between the Tao Te Ching and your appreciation and understanding of Lao Tzu, what do you see? Is this in a sense a kind of updating and amplification of it? Is it the same in its essence? How do you see the interaction between the two books?
Well, in its essence, I think it's absolutely the same, and it's really a, you could say, an unpacking and an elaboration of something that in the original, or at least in my version of it, is extremely dense and sometimes quite hard to fathom, especially if somebody hasn't done a lot of intensive meditation practice. And so Katie, in all of these chapters, has taken a line, a couple of lines, maybe the whole chapter, and made it transparent, because one of her most attractive qualities to me is that she is completely ignorant of all of these traditions, so it comes out very pure. She has only her own experience to relate to, and so I could read a verse and she would talk about it without any spiritual concepts, without any tradition getting in the way as an obstacle. And also, she would tell stories, as I said before, about her life. Sometimes they would occur in an answer to a completely different chapter, and in the process of editing it, I would splice that story into another chapter where it seemed more appropriate. But the stories are wonderful examples of verses that can seem a little abstract, perhaps, or a little removed from the everyday life of an American of the 21st century. And the stories, but also the descriptions that don't have to do with stories, just make it marvelously simple and clear and vivid what place Lao Tzu was coming from and what it looks like to live a fearless, effortless life of open-heartedness and clarity.
Beautifully stated. You know, I'm thinking now of the two things that my mother taught me when I was quite young that I never forgot. She said, you know, of all things, Duncan, in relationship and being with people, sense of humor, the most important. And also, if you ever feel a genuine sense of appreciation for someone, that they're beautiful or they did something very well, be sure to go out of your way to tell them that, because we so often don't do that. You know, people wait until they have a criticism. And those two things were so profound, and I feel them in not only in the work of each of you, but also in Lao Tzu, that there is this sense of the master, as, you know, he or she is referred to, having this quality of appreciation, of welcoming, of gratitude, and also the non-attachment to some idea of self that allows sense of humor to flow freely without impediment, because there's nothing to protect or defend. Yeah. So one can imagine, you know, hanging out with Lao Tzu, maybe a lot of it wordlessly, but a lot of it quite enjoyable with the occasional outbursts of spontaneous laughter.
For me, laughter was always a benchmark of not only a tradition, but of a person, too. Mm-hmm. I don't really connect with or care too much for the spiritual traditions that are solemn, mm-hmm. Although I can see their value, too. Mm-hmm. I love ceremony. Mm-hmm. But to me, what really characterizes the deep and most genuine kind of realization is lightheartedness and how the ease of laughter. Mm-hmm. And I love that about Katie. And I love also something she says about the litmus test for realization being the constant sense of gratitude. Mm-hmm. And the central word there is constant, that it doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. It's not something that comes and goes like, you know, ecstasy, people's experience of ecstasy or people's experience of I had a deep realization then, mm-hmm. you know, something that is not there all the time is not genuine in the most, in the realest sense. So I love it that A Thousand Names for Joy, too, is a very funny book, as well as being a very profound
one.
Sure.
Yes, it is. And the stories are just wonderful. And, you know, one of the persons that I loved to read when I was a young man was Henry Miller. Because of that reason, Henry Miller, he named his autobiography Always Merry and Bright. And I happened to have the good fortune to be out in Santa Barbara when Black Sparrow Press published a little tiny book, which soon went out of print, called On Turning 80. In which I discovered that Henry Miller had been an early admirer of Vivekananda when he came in 1893. I didn't know that. And from India, you know, to the United States. And he said the litmus test to tell whether a spiritual teacher is a charlatan or not is presence or absence of sense of humor. And I said, well, that's spot on, you know. And Nietzsche had that great statement that, you know, come, let us kill the spirit of gravity. You know, I need a God who can dance. And so one of the hallmarks, I think, ironically and in a lovely way about the work is that at a certain point it's effortless and it's very lighthearted. It's yes. not some solemn exercise of, you know, going yeah. to work.
You know? I love to say, you know, there's nothing serious. Mm-hmm. And when people believe there's something serious, that, you know, that's their world. And so that's what the work's about, to question, identify the story and question it.
And as we come suddenly to the end of our time together here, I just want to quote the passage from Lao Tzu that you comment on so well. Two of them come to mind. Compassionate toward yourself, you reconcile all beings in the world. From the Tao Te Ching, and the one you choose at the end here, the more she does for others, the happier she is. The more she gives to others, the wealthier she is. And in conclusion, Katie, you know, you say, on the other side of our thinking, generosity naturally appears. It is our very nature. There's nothing we need to do to achieve it. It's simply what we are. And again, for spending this really delightful time together and for being who you are, both of you, Katie and Stephen, I want to express my own gratitude and lightheartedness and appreciation of not only the time we spend physically together here, but the times over the years that I've felt in contact with each of you separately through your work and then in the good fortune we've all had of meeting together from time to time. And again, from my heart to yours, I want to just express my gratitude and I'm sure that of our many listeners.
Thank you, Duncan.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the way you just help so many people through your programming.
It's a mutual inspiration. It's a real mm-hmm. dialogue. And on that note, I want to just identify myself as your host, Duncan Campbell. As we come to the end of this living dialogue, I've been with Byron Katie, the author of two best-selling books, Loving What Is and I Need Your Love, Is That True? And her new book, A Thousand Names for Joy, Living in Harmony with the Way Things Are. Her website is www.thework.com, where you will find her blog, her schedule, a network of facilitators, a free hotline, audio and video clips, articles, and basic information about the work. And Stephen Mitchell, whose many books include the best-selling Tao Te Ching, The Gospel According to Jesus, and Gilgamesh. You can read extensive excerpts from all of his books, including one of my favorites, The Enlightened Heart, a collection of spiritual poetry from the Upanishads through Rilke and other 20th century writers. And all of this is on his website, www.stephenmitchellbooks.com. And so, with that, I invite you to be with us again next time on Living Dialogues. And once you have entered your free subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media, future Living Dialogues will automatically be downloaded to your computer on a weekly basis. If you'd like to obtain a CD, MP3, or full transcript of this dialogue or additional dialogues I've done with the many other transformational thinkers listed on my website, livingdialogues.com, you can contact me through that website, livingdialogues.com. That's livingdialogues.com. Thanks again for your deep listening. All the very best.
Find more great shows like this on PersonalLifeMedia.com.